Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's California Election Special. Last week, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein and California State Senator Kevin De Leon had their first and likely only face-to-face conversation. It really wasn't a debate. The moderator basically asked both of them questions, but they never really talked to each other. They both said they support major changes to the U.S. healthcare system. Feinstein advocates for gradual reform and a public option, whereas De Leon wants Medicare for all. Some of the most striking differences were about U.S. foreign policy. Senator Feinstein discussed improved relations with North Korea and brought up the need for an investigation into what happened to journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Kevin De Leon took an even sharper turn about what is happening now in the Middle East.
We have been in Afghanistan for 17 years now. In Iraq, we have been there for 15 years now. Those are longer than the Vietnam Wars. We have spent more than $6 trillion of American taxpayer dollars that should have been spent on healthcare, on debt-free college education, on investments on clean energy. These are serious votes. And as a result, this region, this area is not more stable. It's unstable, even more so. It's not more safe, it's less safe. And our security as a nation is in much more peril.
After those remarks, California U.S. Senate candidate Kevin De Leon went on to call for ending weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Kevin De Leon has many endorsements, including the California Democratic Party, Healthcare for All California, San Francisco Tenant Rights Association, the California Labor Federation, the California Nurses Association, SEIU California, and 350 Bay Area Action. Joining us to talk more about his platform and what he wants to do in Washington, D.C. is California Senator Kevin De Leon. Senator De Leon led the California Senate from 2014 to March of this year. He has also served as an assembly member, and he joins us from Marketplace's studios in Los Angeles. Hi, Senator De Leon. Welcome to Your Call.
Rose, good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I should mention that we sent several invitations to Senator Dianne Feinstein, but her office has not responded to our invitation. I want to ask you about what you both said at what I'm guessing will be the one and only conversation that you're having face to face. When you were both talking about what things are like in California, Senator Feinstein said California is a major player on the Pacific Rim, and she wants to make sure that people can earn a good living. She said economic well-being is very important. And, you know, you took it much further. And I have to say, whenever we have on local, state, or national politicians from California, they rarely really talk about poverty and inequality. You said, although we're the fifth largest economy in the world, we have so many Californians who've been left behind. How many here are a paycheck or two from either living at home with family or friends, or worse, living in a car or on the streets? You said that is the plight of so many Californians. And of course, this is so true. No matter where we live in the state, we see it. Massive homelessness, poverty, an affordable housing crisis. You know, given that this state is run by Democrats, Senator De Leon, how do you explain how we got to this point?
Well, I can tell you this. You are right. We are the fifth largest economy in the world. There's only four large economies in the state of California, United States of America, China, Japan, and Germany. And we have left millions of Californians behind. I think it's incumbent that we have a voice in Washington that is going to be on the front lines and not on the sidelines. Rose, I believe strongly that these are very dangerous, very consequential times in our nation's history, and that we're engaged in a battle for our nation's soul against a president without one. So you stated earlier that I believe the status quo in Washington is either unwilling or incapable of fighting back. And that's why I believe that's time that we stop biding our time and biding our tongue while this president does everything within his power to undermine California's progress. Now, although we're the fifth largest economy in the world, we still have a lot of work to do in our home state. As you stated a few moments ago, as I stated at the conversation that we had with U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, we need to deal with the issue of poverty. We need to deal with the issue of homelessness. We need to deal with the issue of the housing crisis that has impacted Northern California, Southern California, and points in between. And that's why I believe strongly that we need a senator that reflects our values and will step up and speak out and fight for Californians every day in every which way.
But a lot of these problems, as you know, did not start with Donald Trump. And if you can just, again, talk about how you think we got here in California. Most big cities are run by Democrats. They're the ones making the decisions. In Sacramento, it's run by Democrats. Now, there are very different Democrats. There are progressive Democrats. There are corporate Democrats. But can you talk about, you know, why is it, do you think we have, in such a wealthy place like the Bay Area, why do we have so many people who are living on our streets and who living their cars and, you know, really struggle to make ends meet?
Sure.
Why is that?
No, that's a good question. I think that wages are simply not kept up with working class Californians. I think that we have the housing crisis in California. Obviously, we have a lack of inventory. We have the rent control issue that is Prop 10 that will be before us in the fall, obviously November 6th. And we're dealing with this issue. I'm proud to have negotiated the highest minimum wage in the country at $15 an hour. But we have a lot of Californians who are working not one job, but they're working two, three jobs. Wages simply have not kept up with the realities of working Californians. We have the housing crisis because we have not been building. We have an inventory issue, a lack of stock for Californians, and that has made the housing crisis even much more acute, especially in the Bay Area. And on the federal issues with regards to the issue of health care, we have Californians who are making a decision whether do we choose between paying our rent or mortgage, or do we choose paying our health care costs or medication or food for our children? Single-payer, Medicare for all, the issue of health care coverage is better under a federal framework. And because of the lack of action in Washington, D.C., this has had a huge impact on California.
What about the Democrats in Sacramento? I mean, it seems like they're not doing enough to really tackle these issues. And
well, I would say, and I would gently yet respectfully and politely push back on that right there. I think that Democrats in the state capitol have responded, unlike any other state legislative body or the Congress in the nation, by raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, by moving Proposition 1, which is on our ballot, that's $3 billion for the construction of affordable housing. You got Prop 2, and I know Prop 2 because I'm the author. I wrote Prop 2, No Place Like Home, which will provide $2.2 billion for the construction of permanent housing solutions for chronically homeless individuals who are mentally ill. So we're moving proactively measures, either through the legislative house or for the people to vote constitutionally come November 6th. So that's why I would sort of gently yet diplomatically and respectfully push back a tad bit, because we have been responding, unlike the lack of action in Washington, D.C.
What else do you think Democrats in Sacramento can do to tackle the homeless and poverty crisis in this state?
Well, one of the biggest issues with regards to housing, I should say homelessness, is mental illnesses. A lot of Californians who are homeless today are also mentally ill. Not all. We have families who are living in cars who either got fired from their job or because of a health traumatic issue are no longer able to continue to work. And like I said, many folks are one or two paychecks away from living with family, with a friend, or living in a car, or living on the streets, the worst case scenario. I believe that my proposition to No Place Like Home is one huge proactive step to get folks off the streets and into permanent housing solutions. You got to put a roof over their head. You got to stabilize their families. Then you have to provide the wraparound services, the mental health services, the psychotherapeutic services, which will be very critical to get them on a pathway to living a better life. Some folks, it'll happen very quickly. Some folks, it'll be a lifetime journey to deal with the trauma of their issues. Some folks, it's innate with regards to schizophrenia, with bipolarness, depression. It'll be a lifetime journey. But I think that providing housing solutions, working with local governments, I think local governments are going to be very critical because we have a lot of NIMBYism also hurting the development of housing solutions for individuals who are homeless. We're in this together, and we have to work together and roll up our sleeves.
I'm glad you're bringing up Prop 2, because this is one of the props that's not getting much attention, unlike, mm-hmm. say, Proposition 10 that would repeal Costa-Hawkins. So if Proposition 2 passes, and I'm reading right now from votersedge.org, which is a great voter guide from MapLight and the League of Women Voters. And it says Prop 2 would allow the state to sell up to $2 billion in bonds to help pay for the new mental health housing program. Up to $140 million from Prop 63 funds could be used each year to pay for these funds. Who would be making these decisions if this prop passes?
Well, Prop 2 is no new taxes. It's no new sales tax. It's no new personal income tax, parcel tax. Prop 2 comes from $2.2 billion dollars that are already in existence. So what I do is I reprioritize these dollars for permanent housing solutions. The money would be distributed from the state of California and would go to the various counties. So, for example, in the Bay Area, it'd be the counties San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Clara, Alameda, Contra Costa, Sonoma, Napa, and so forth. The county would be responsible for the distribution of these dollars for the construction with nonprofit agencies and with developers, with homeless experts to build or to rehab, if you will, or retrofit existing buildings to get folks off the street. And be mindful, these are not, this is not, it's not about shelters. This is not transitional housing. This is not something that's a band-aid or temporary. We're talking about permanent housing solutions to get folks off the street once and for all. And it's the largest amount of money to be invested for housing for chronically homeless individuals with mental illnesses.
I started by talking about California's problems because it's really, really sad what you see. I mean, I was in near Arcata and Eureka recently. So many people on the streets. I grew up in Petaluma. When I go home to visit family, at every stop sign, there's someone holding a sign asking for money. I mean, I did not see that about 3 years ago. And even in San Francisco, in various neighborhoods, you see homeless people. I mean, it's getting worse. And I guess I pushed you on this because I feel like if we don't really truly tackle this issue, it's going to continue getting worse as inequality widens and wages, they move a little bit. But I mean, a dollar an hour here or there really doesn't help someone who's struggling to make ends meet.
No, Rose, I think you're right. And I think you pushing is perfectly fine. It's the right thing to do, because I think that elected officials, current elected officials, and those who aspire to be your voice at the federal level deserve to be pushed and pushed really hard. That's very fair to do. My concern, again, is I agree that we unemployment is very low across the nation and in California. However, that doesn't really describe the reality for many working families who work in two or three or maybe even four jobs to try to make ends meet. Minimum wage, the highest in the nation, $15 an hour, that's not a livable wage. That's very different from a minimum wage. And that's why I want to be in a position to be your voice in Washington to move policies, for example, in the clean energy space, taking advantage of converting these environmental challenges and converting them into real economic opportunities, high-wage-paying jobs. We have to create the marketplace for high-wage-paying jobs, and I think we can do so in California. We've created 500,000 jobs in the clean energy space in California. That's 10 times more jobs than there are coal mining jobs in all of America. But you need the leadership to intentionally and purposefully and politically move the policies with a sense of force to make things happen. Because if you don't, if you are resigned to defeatism, if you're just on the sidelines and not on the front lines, this situation is going to get even worse, even in a great state like California, being the fifth largest economy in the world. And as we know, when you disaggregate the data, we have so many Californians are being left behind. And the one point that you made, we've always had a homeless issue in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and elsewhere, but we have never seen it at this level, which is a crisis proportion. Homelessness for a lot of folks have always been, if you went downtown and you saw folks, asking for money or with a sign. But now all of a sudden it's become a human crisis where everybody's talking about it on the left and right, because the homelessness has now been pushed out of skid rows of our local, urban cities, and now are in neighborhoods. They're under freeway underpasses, all over Los Angeles, all over the Bay Area, and so forth. And we're grappling with this issue, but we as in government at the federal, local, and state level need to come together and deal with this issue quickly, because if we don't, it's just going to get worse.
Today we are speaking with California State Senator Kevin De Leon, who is running to be the U.S. Senator representing California. If you have any questions for Senator De Leon, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Last week, California Senator Kevin De Leon and Senator Dianne Feinstein had their first and is it safe to guess? Is it going to be your only really face-to-face conversation, Senator De Leon?
Well, unfortunately, that may be the reality. We had asked months ago for three debates, one at Stanford University, her alma mater, one in Southern California, and one in Central Valley, in Fresno. And I think that it is important, because it shows respect to the voters, to present ourselves to the voters, who we are, what we stand for, what our vision is, what our accomplishments are, and what we want to do, if given an opportunity to be your voice in Washington, D.C. They didn't want to do the debates. We had hoped that the PPIC debate in San Francisco last week would be a formal debate with independent journalists, live television at 7 p.m. at night, where the vast majority of the electorate in California could actually view it themselves. Unfortunately, in the negotiations, there was a refusal to adhere to that. They wanted lunchtime, no live television, no independent journalist to ask questions. So I think it was unfortunate. I think it was deeply unfortunate, because this is an opportunity in a very difficult time in our nation's history for voters to hear what our views are, and more importantly, what would we do if given an opportunity to be their voice in Washington?
And we sent several invitations to Senator Dianne Feinstein, but her office has not responded to our invitation. Senator De Leon, why did you decide to run? It's such an expensive state, as you know, to run in, unfortunately. Senator Dianne Feinstein is a longtime household name. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to run?
Like I said, a few moments ago, these are very dangerous, consequential times in our nation's history. And when I heard that our senior senator at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club last year stated that that we needed to be patient with President Trump, and hopes that, in the hopes that he could be a good president in the future, that hit me like a 2x4 across the forehead. I was stunned by the comment, because the comment showed a lack of deep understanding what was happening in the country, but especially what was happening here in California. Mothers and fathers who are being pursued by ICE agents, children who are who have anxiety, panic, fear, because they don't know if their mothers are going to pick them up after school if they've been detained by ICE agents. This is after the president pulled out of the Paris Accords of 2015 on climate change. This is after the Muslim ban. This is after 3 weeks after the tragedy of Charlottesville, Virginia. And to have the senior senator make such a comment was shocking, to say the least. So I thought that perhaps California needs an alternative voice, a new voice, a new vision, a new approach, and change. And I was honored and lucky enough to get into the top two, a huge field of 32 candidates, to get the endorsement of the Democratic Party, the nurses of California, working men and women who are home care workers and janitors and men and women who work on the ports of Long Beach and L.A. and Oakland and San Francisco. And it's been an incredible journey to go up and down the state of California. Last night I was in Fresno, Visalia, Sanger. Today I'm in Los Angeles. I'll be in San Diego in a couple hours. I'm traveling up and down the state, talking to all voters. But that was the reason why. And being the youngest child of a single immigrant mother with a third grade education, a woman who worked her fingers to the bone, working in the very wealthy enclave in La Jolla, California, I was offended by that comment. And it showed to me the huge disconnection, the cognitive dissonance between a senior senator in Washington and the reality of everyday Californians.
As you know, I mean, you've said this, you feel like the status quo in Washington is not fighting back. You know, a lot of people lately are saying, what is Chuck Schumer doing? You know, where is Nancy Pelosi? I mean, where is the Democratic Party? I mean, of course, there are different sets of Democrats in D.C. like there are in Sacramento, more progressive, more corporate. What kind of senator would you be in terms of, you know, would you kind of put yourself out there? A lot of people were wondering this with Kamala Harris. Was she going to put herself out there quickly, and or was she going to hold back? What would you say, especially in this very difficult time?
During these very difficult times, I'd be doing what I've been doing today, you know, speaking truth to power on the issues that I care deeply about for everyday Californians, fighting for health care for all, not Medicare for some, fighting for what is an existential threat to our humanity, to our way of life, to our planet, the issue of climate change, fighting for immigration reform, because I believe our nation has turned its back on our family of immigrants. Speaking truth to power, even if mathematically you're in the minority, you don't psychologically assume the mindset of being in the minority. These are issues, these are values that Californians and Americans care deeply about. You have to speak truth to power. You just can't say, well, you know what, we're mathematically in the minority, we just can't do nothing, we're just going to resign ourselves to be on the sidelines as opposed to the front lines. And do and accomplish the issues that that I was successful here, moving California to 100% clean energy, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, equal pay for women doing equal work. Sanctuary State, I'm the author of Sanctuary State. Folks say, well, you know, easier said than done, Kevin, because the Republicans control the bicameral legislative branch of the government, as well as the judicial branch and the executive branch. It doesn't make a difference because you have to speak truth to power and you have to fight for your values in Washington, D.C. And quite frankly, I simply don't see that with our senior senator. I see the comity of a bygone era where folks perhaps got along with each other to a certain degree, but that's no longer the case. I mean, these Republicans exercise power unlike anyone we've ever seen before. Unfortunately, but the reality is they go for the jugular. And we are playing by these country club rules in Washington, D.C., and that doesn't work for California.
Today we're speaking with California State Senator Kevin De Leon, who is running to represent California in Washington as a U.S. Senator. And if you have any questions or comments for Senator De Leon, the number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's kick it off with Susie, who'd like to talk about Prop 10, which would repeal Costa-Hawkins, giving city governments more control over rent control. Hi, Susie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. And thank you. Good morning, Senator, and thank you so much for your support of Proposition 10. People like me who work with our homeless population understand that it'll address our housing crisis, but the opposition is saying the opposite. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to how you think Proposition 10 is an effective solution to the affordable housing and homelessness crisis.
Well, thank you, Susie, for the question. Obviously, we have a housing crisis in our great state of California, and we have Measures 1 and Measures 2 that promise to leverage billions of dollars to build housing. But in the immediate, with regards to Prop 10, this will help local governments, you know, address skyrocketing rents. There has never been an instance where a building has been curtailed because of rent control, not in San Francisco before 1979, not even in Los Angeles before 1978. How many folks do we know who have been residents, tenants of their apartment for 30, 35, 40 years and all of a sudden that Social Security check that they're relying will no longer suffice to keep that roof over their head, and now they're being evicted and they have nowhere to go. That actually contributes to the homelessness population in the Bay Area, as well as Los Angeles and other cities throughout California. That's why I think that Prop 10 is needed. And we have to obviously do our job by building capacity, more infrastructure in California. But that's why I support Prop 10.
Well, thank you for calling, Susie. We should mention we've got updates on the money that's being spent on Prop 10. Again, this is from Voters Edge. On the yes side, $20 million. Top funder is the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. The no side, wow, they're almost to $60 million. Top funders, California Association of Realtors at $5 million, Blackstone Property Partners. That's the firm that bought so many single-family homes during the crash. That's about $5 million, and Western National is about $5 million. You know, Senator De Leon, as you know, so much money is spent on these propositions. This one alone, almost $80 million. No, on the no side, no on 10, yeah. It's almost $60 million.
Listen, I've always believed in clean money. I've always believed in transparency. I've always believed that we need to overturn Citizens United. I think that with so much money involved in the political process, it corrupts the process. And oftentimes voters who are just trying to make ends meet get very confused by ads that are they're very tricky. And a lot of voters don't have the time to really sit down and study and go over, especially if the ballot is crowded with candidates as well as ballot initiatives. The less money we have in the system, the better I think it is for democracy.
Since we're talking about housing, Paul Bowden, who is the executive director of RAP, a really incredible homeless organization in San Francisco, he often says there's no possible way that cities alone can solve the affordable housing and the homeless crisis. He said it's even hard for the state to do it on its own. And he points to the fact that HUD has just been gutted since the Ronald Reagan days. And under Trump, of course, they want even deeper cuts to HUD. So if you were able to go to Washington, for example, what are your thoughts about those cuts, and how would you try to ensure that HUD actually has the funding it needs so we can build housing that's actually affordable, but in the true sense of affordable? Because for so many people, affordable housing really isn't affordable.
Yeah, Paul's absolutely right. I think at the federal level, the response has been abysmal, to say the least. They don't view it as a crisis. I think the leadership that we've had in California with regards to housing doesn't view it as a real crisis. HUD is a shell of itself because it has been gutted. It just almost exclusively just deals with housing for working families in a sort of private sector way of providing for vouchers, you know, Section 8 vouchers. We all know about Section 8 housing and these vouchers. You know, here's a voucher. Go find an apartment. If you can find one, fantastic. If not, was, you know, tough luck. And that's not the right way to go about dealing with this crisis. We need the federal government to step up, and I would fight for more funding. And I think that's why there's a huge contrast, Rose, with regards to the current incumbent and myself. Listen, I know what it feels like to be a renter all of my life. I know what it feels like when the landlord would come to the house, knock on the door, and my mother, in Spanish, she would say, you know, shh, cállense. No digan nada, you know, be quiet, don't say a word, because we couldn't make rent for that month. And it was embarrassing, and it was humiliating when the landlord is banging on the front door, yelling your mother's name. And I know that my story is not unique, because I know a lot of families go through that up and down the state of California. But coming from that experience, and with the current incumbent, and I don't critique her or besmirch her for her upbringing, we have two very different lives, two different backgrounds. We grew up in two very different worlds, but I don't believe that urgency is there for the issue of homelessness. The urgency is there for the housing crisis. The urgency is there for those who lack health care. The urgency is not there for those who are being deported, detained, dreamers. It's not there. You can sort of articulate that I'm for these issues. That's one thing. But one thing to feel it and understand it and know what it feels like, not knowing if you're going to make the rent this month, not knowing if you're going to be able to take your kid to a doctor's appointment because it may break you for that month, that's something that comes from within inside. And when you know and you understand the panic, the anxiety, the hopes and aspirations of everyday voters in California, I think that's what gives me an incredible edge over our current incumbent.
Today we're speaking with California State Senator Kevin De Leon, who is running to represent California in Washington as a U.S. senator. We did invite Dianne Feinstein to join us, but her office has not responded to our invitation. You can find the only one face-to-face conversation between Senator Feinstein and Senator De Leon at yourcallradio.org. Senator De Leon is the first in his family to graduate from high school. Before he entered politics, he served the public as a community organizer, teaching English as a second language. He also spent 5 years at the California Teachers Association. And he is receiving support from the California Nurses Association, San Francisco Tenant Rights Association, and the California Democratic Party, among many other organizations. If you have a question or a comment for Senator De Leon, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Another difference, Senator, between you and Senator Feinstein at this conversation, it was about health care. Senator Feinstein said, quote, "There should be a public option and then maybe reduce the age of eligibility for Medicare to 55. You said health care is a human right. I believe in Medicare for all, not Medicare for some. I don't believe in a public option. You said you also spent the majority of your childhood without health coverage. You helped create Healthy California. In your view, I mean, what would a Medicare for all or health care for all system look like?"
Well, let me just reiterate what you said. I spent the vast majority of my childhood without health care coverage. So I don't believe that folks, families have to be forced to choose between making their rent or paying for health care coverage, or, you know, food on the table, or medication. I believe that healthcare is a human right, and I believe in Medicare for all. The status quo simply is not sustainable, and we must do something about this because the current system is not going to work for all Californians. And currently, we spend about $3.3 trillion nationwide on healthcare. There are numerous studies out there that point very clearly and directly, and they have been reviewed 100 times over, that if we go to a Medicare for all system, that in short, healthcare coverage for everybody, we will save $2 trillion over a course of 10 years. $2 trillion. That's about $200 billion on an annual basis. And if you don't believe me, listen, then go believe the Koch brothers, because they're the ones who actually initiated that study. Right now, we're getting older, and we're actually living longer. Mm. And our system right now is driving people to bankruptcy. We're the wealthiest nation in the world, and we spend the most money in the world. Yet our healthcare outcomes are disastrous in comparison to Japan, Germany, United Kingdom, our friends to the north of us, Canada, many Scandinavian countries. So I think, and let me say this too, because Washington always seems to always find money to fund its priorities, whether it's the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, tax cuts for the wealthy, but it can never find the money to invest in the most precious human capital asset of this country, and that is Americans. And that's why it's about values and what our priorities are in Washington, D.C. Because when it comes to Medicare for all, when it comes to the issue of health care, we politicize it and we can never do anything about it because it's just too expensive. It's always too expensive. But Washington always finds that money to fund their priorities. Mm-hmm. Tax cuts, you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're still ongoing. Weapons sales to the Saudis, et cetera. So I that's why I believe we need that leadership. You know, when you say you're for universal health care, as my opponent does, that's sort of kind of like saying, it is almost like saying, I want everybody to be happy. I want everyone to have health care. I don't have a plan, but I want universal health care. That's not a plan. Medicare for all is actually a plan, because we currently have it today. A lot of folks are happy with it. We can expand it. If we have to do so incrementally, so be it. But the public option in itself, to me, is not workable.
I was reading recently about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, and basically one of his proposals would be to just drop the age, 65 to 55 to 45 to 35, until everybody's covered. Right. Is that what...
I would agree with that, too. Doing it in an incrementalist way, you can't just do one large... expansion. There'll be a shock to the system and to the economy itself. I would do it in a very astute way, and I think we have to do it in an incrementalist way. Just continuously drop the age limit continuously until we have all Americans that are covered.
Today we're speaking with California State Senator Kevin De Leon, who is running to represent California in Washington as U.S. Senator. We sent several invitations to Senator Dianne Feinstein, but her office has not responded to our invite. Last week, Senator Feinstein and Senator De Leon had their first and likely only face-to-face conversation. If you have a question for Senator De Leon, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Senator De Leon.
Hi, John. How are you doing? Good morning.
Hey, fine. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Not bad. Working this campaign, going up and down the state.
It's nice to see you as a candidate in California. Leadership and many of the ideas you are talking about echo my own personal beliefs. I did want to ask you one specific question related to homelessness and home ownership. Here in San Francisco, we're suffering a major crisis, which is homelessness, which is maybe related to mental health issues, and there's a lot that's going on here. You mentioned that you've been a home renter your whole life, and what I'm wondering is, what is your position on home ownership in California as it relates to private enterprise, and private enterprise maybe helping the homeless crisis by building more homes, not through government subsidies, but through enabling free enterprise and the market to take care of itself?
Well, listen, if folks want to own a home, their own property, I'm for it. I'm not against it. I believe part of the challenge is getting access to capital. And if you're a working family and you want to own a home, it's going to be quite challenging given the valuation of properties today, especially in the Bay Area, because the lack of inventory, the lack of stock to begin with. That's why we have to start building in a very smart, intelligent way that does not adversely impact the environment. But we have to build. There's no question about it. It doesn't make a difference if you're on the left or right. You have to start building more housing if we're going to start dropping the price point of getting access to purchasing a home. But that being said, you need access to capital. And I don't think that the traditional banks right now, contingent on your FICO score or lending money to folks whose quality of paper is not supreme. And that's why, the rich get richer, because when the quality of your paper is very high, you get access to capital. And when you're trying to make ends meet, but you want that American dream, that California dream, you're not going to get access to that capital. I think that we need to do better with regards to financial products at a low interest point, price point, so working families can get access to it. I'm not into irresponsible lending, but I will say this, is that if you do lend... and there are cases with certain banks, they're non-traditional banks. If you do lend to working class families, they have a very high rate of paying back their loan and not defaulting. So I don't believe the banks have been very helpful, truth be told, with getting access to capital. Tactically, we can raise the minimum wage. We can create more parks and open space. We can have health care. These are all tactics overall to improve the quality of life, the human condition for all Californians, for all Americans. But getting access to capital is really, really critical. And I think we have a huge problem in this country.
Well, thank you for calling in, John. Senator De Leon, I wanted to also ask you about U.S. foreign policy before we end the show. This is another issue that came up during the conversation you were in with Senator Feinstein last week. And we played a clip during the intro. You pointed out that the U.S. has spent more than $6 trillion, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan in these various wars that are lasting incredibly long. You also said, and, you know, you rarely hear this from Democrats, quote, "We need to get out of the business of bombing other nations. We've got to get out of the business of nation building. You don't go and bomb a whole country and invade a whole country to deal with the issue of terrorism." This really stood out for me because I rarely hear Democrats say these things. Why is that?
Well, I think it's just common sense, Rose, and not a foreign policy expert. You know, to me, it's common sense. When you vote for war, we have to realize what's at stake. We're talking about American lives, other lives, and American taxpayer dollars. And when Washington sends our children, our families, our loved ones into war, and when they have no credible plan to get them back home, that tells me that something's wrong with the individuals who are making the decisions and those who vote to enable the federal government to go into these wars. And Senator Dianne Feinstein has continuously voted for wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. And to date, we've been in Afghanistan for 17 years. The cost of this war has been the disenfranchisement of an entire generation. And there are families who will never see their children again. There are children, sons and daughters, who will never see their mothers and fathers again. And we need an immediate plan to exit Afghanistan because the British invaded Afghanistan and tried to conquer Afghanistan. The former Soviet Union tried to conquer Afghanistan. We're there now 17 years. That's longer than the Vietnam War. We've spent close to $2, maybe $3 trillion in Afghanistan alone. The region's not safer. We invaded Iraq. Senator Feinstein voted for that war in Iraq. And be mindful about one thing. Let's not forget that ISIS was created directly from the resistance to the invasion in Iraq. There was no ISIS before the Iraq War. So Dianne Feinstein acquiesced and collaborated with George W. Bush, with Donald Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney. This is their war, but we're paying the price for it. And Dianne Feinstein was a yes vote for the Iraq War, as well as Afghanistan. These wars, and when our representatives take their votes or make their votes in Washington, they have huge consequences. So if we're spending $6 trillion today on these two wars, and we're selling weapons to the Saudis, and then they say, well, we have no money for helping homeless folks. Or we have no money to really shore up the budgets of HUD to deal with the issue of affordability. We have no money to deal with kids who are saddled with debt, paying both principal and interest well into their 30s and 40s and 50s when they graduate from college, if they graduate from college. And very few graduate from college in 4 years. Or let's say we have no money for health care. Or we need to privatize Social Security. We need to increase the age of Social Security because it's not sustainable. Well, of course, because we've been spending money elsewhere, GOP tax cuts, which Senator Feinstein voted for in the past, along with two wars, and those are the values that are not reflective of who we are today as a state. We're innovative, we're creative, we're disruptive, we challenge the status quo, we're the most diverse state in the nation, if not the entire world. And that's why we need a new voice, because when we're dealing with the issue of foreign policy, especially within our own Western Hemisphere, we have folks who are fleeing Central America because they're caught between the Colombian drug lords, the manufacturers, and the largest consumer on planet Earth of illicit drugs, which is the United States of America. You have deep entrenched poverty. You have climate change that is wrecking already very difficult poverty-stricken nations that never had strong democratic institutions, judicial, legislative, executive branch. You had a U.S. government that always aided, you know, strong men, dictators in Central America. That failed foreign policy of the United States contributes greatly to the mass migration patterns to the United States of America. And these are the decisions that are made in Washington, D.C.
And Senator Feinstein last year told Mother Jones that, quote, you know, voting for the invasion of Iraq in 2002 is, quote, the decision that I regret the most and I have to live with it. And again, I wish we could have had her on today to ask about these issues, but we did reach out to Senator Feinstein's office and she did not respond to our invitation. Senator De Leon, just recently, a couple of months ago, 40 Democrats in the Senate joined Republicans and voted for a $717 billion military spending bill, which does not include money for health care. So much of this goes to weapons companies. Senator Dianne Feinstein did vote for that. How would you have voted on that?
I wouldn't have voted for it. The reason why is this, that you even had generals from the Pentagon, from the Department of Defense, sheepishly, you know, remarked that we're not asking for all this money. It's not part of our budget request. Of course, agencies in Washington, D.C. are always going to try to get as much as money as they can when it comes to budget crunching, budget decision making. But when you have generals out of the Pentagon almost embarrassingly say, we're not really asking for this. You don't have to give it to us. Yet you have Washington Democrats, you know, and Senator Feinstein going along with it. The reality is I think the defense industrial complex drives the foreign policy decision making for the senior senator of California. And we need very responsible, astute decision making made in Washington, D.C. You listen to everybody across the board, and then you make a decision. What is best for your constituents? What is best for California? What is best for the nation? And to date, the decisions that she has made have been disastrous, because national security and intelligence are perceived as her strongest skill sets, experiences in Washington, D.C. And I would submit to you as well as to the voters, and I would say it if Ms. Feinstein were with us on this show today, that they have been spectacular failures on her part. In 2018, to vote to allow the federal government to spy on American citizens without a judicial warrant, removing effectively another branch of government, a co-equal branch of government, federal judges, to ascertain whether if there is correct information to actually, in a bona fide way, agree with the eavesdropping, the spying on American citizens, if they in fact are a real threat to Americans, to American soil, to allow this executive branch, the Donald J. Trump administration, to unilaterally make the decision to spy on American citizens without a judicial warrant is extraordinary. And those votes are not reflective of who we are in California.
You just said that you're not a foreign policy expert, and I wonder, okay, let's say you don't win this time around. If Feinstein retires in 3 or 4 years, Gavin Newsom could possibly appoint you. You could run again. I mean, you could ultimately end up in the Senate. And you are going to have to vote on very important issues. For example, the U.S. is supporting the Saudis who are bombing Yemen. It's a horrific humanitarian crisis. I mean, the United States sells weapons to so many countries around the world. There's Israel and Palestine, South America, Central America. I mean, the U.S. has such an impact on other people around the country. How do you plan to, you know, learn more, brush up on those issues? So, I mean, the decision that you will make will, in some cases, determine if people live or die. So how do you?
I understand.
Yeah, how do you plan to really tackle foreign policy if you end up in Washington?
Well, you know, we need a new way of thinking when it comes to foreign policy globally, but especially in the Pacific Rim, and especially our own Western Hemisphere. If given the opportunity to be your voice in Washington, D.C., I'd really roll up my sleeves and recalibrate our foreign policy foggy bottom in Washington, D.C., which I believe both Democrats and Republicans have not. Done a very good job with regards to foreign policy in our own Western Hemisphere. I have engaged in foreign policy. About a month ago, I met and I hosted the Prime Minister of the government of Spain, the President of Spain, Pedro Sanchez. Last year in July, I met with the Prime Minister of Japan in Tokyo, Mr. Shinzo Abe. We had a meeting where I headed a delegation of California state senators. And just last year, I met with the Foreign Affairs Secretary of Mexico, Luis Videgaray. And the President of the Republic of Mexico hosted me at a private meeting at Los Pinos, which would be the equivalent to the White House in Mexico City. So I have my opinions. I have my thoughts. Perhaps they're not viewed within the Washington speak as the establishment, but I have my very strong thoughts on the issue of foreign policy. And I think that we need a voice that's strong in Washington, D.C. to recalibrate the way we treat other nations, how much money we spend on nation building, how we go about terrorism. I think you go and you seek those who seek us harm, but you don't bomb an entire nation and then occupy a nation and now have to figure out how do we get out of it, you know. And that's been a failed foreign policy approach of the United States of America, of our federal government. But we have a California senior senator that has acquiesced with the establishment authority in Washington, and it simply has not worked for us in California. We are home to the largest number of immigrants from all over the world. We are the gateway to the Pacific Rim, to Japan, to China, to the Philippines, to South Korea, North Korea, and elsewhere. Now, obviously, the Western Hemisphere, Mexico, Latin America, Central America, South America, the Caribbean. We need someone who understands these nations. We understand what's at stake economically, politically, militarily, environmentally, labor laws, commerce, and trade. And I just think that our center has been either slow or not well advised when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, Senator De Leon, I know you have to leave a couple minutes early, so thank you so much.
No, I'll stay as long as you want.
Oh,
I'll stay if you want.
Okay. I thought your press person was calling saying you had to get off the phone.
Oh, I see.
No, that's great. National security, I think this is so important because so much money is spent on weapons. What about climate change? You, at this conversation, said you want to put the U.S. on a track to 100% clean energy and renewable energy.
That is correct. Listen, I believe that our children have a God-given right to breathe clean air, and I represent a district that has seven major freeways that crisscross it like a hydra-headed serpent choking the air, the oxygen out of a young girl's lungs. The number one reason for absenteeism in our public schools is due to asthma. Mm. And in California, we have seven of the top 10 most polluted cities in America. Several of them are in the Southern California Basin, and many of them are in the Central Valley. I'm the author of 100% Clean Energy. So California is the largest economy in the world to legally commit itself, mandate itself to 100% clean energy. This is a real opportunity to grow this economy. And they said it couldn't be done. The fossil fuel industry and other very powerful political interests spent tens of millions of dollars to oppose it. But what I did is I organized a large coalition of mothers whose children suffer from asthma. I organized senior citizen groups who are the most vulnerable to triple-digit heat waves, environmental justice, high school and college students who want a better future for themselves and their children, faith-based organizations, and especially the women and men of labor who are going to build a clean energy future, who are going to have high-wage paying jobs. So I want to introduce a national clean energy plan and put this nation on track to 100% clean energy. We can grow this economy. We can reduce our greenhouse gas carbon emissions, CO2, carbon dioxide, which is atmospheric. And we can reduce dramatically our criteria pollutants. That's NOx, SOx, particulate matter 2.5. That's that ugly brown haze that we see and that our children breathe into their lungs. We have no other choice because climate change is an existential threat to our way of life, to our humanity, and to our planet. And we need to move this because this is a national security issue.
And just quickly, you know that Governor Brown has been protested over fracking. Where do you stand on fracking?
Mm-hmm. I oppose fracking. I don't think if we're going to move towards a 100% clean energy future, if we're going to move to transportation electrification, zero emissions vehicles, whether they're electric vehicles, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, or other technologies that will be created in the future, the time is now to stop fracking.
Senator De Leon, thank you so much for joining us.
Rose, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much. And folks, don't forget to vote November 6th.
Thank you. That is California State Senator Kevin De Leon, who is running to serve California in Washington as a U.S. Senator. We sent several invites to Senator Dianne Feinstein, but her office has not responded to our invitation. Thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. Thanks to Laura Wenis for line producing, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.